Hello, and welcome to another edition of the BJ Psych Advances podcast. My name is Oliver Gale Grant, and I'm joined today by Dr. Rachel Gibbons, consultant psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, and group analyst. She is chair of the Working Group on the Effect of Suicide and Homicide on Clinicians, the co-chair of the Patient Safety Group, and the vice chair of the Faculty of Medical Psychotherapy at the Royal College of Psychiatrists. Rachel, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, hello. Thank you for inviting me.
We're here today to discuss your new paper, The Mourning Process and Its Importance in Mental Illness, a Psychoanalytic Understanding of Psychiatric Diagnosis and Classification. So give us a brief summary of what this paper is all about.
Well, I think it's basically about two different large areas. And the first is bringing together psychoanalytic understanding and psychiatric understanding. And I've hoped to write it in a way that something is synthesized with the aim of bringing a deeper understanding. For me, when I started in psychiatry, I was very surprised at the division that there was between the sort of psychological and the biological. And the aim of this paper is to try to bring that together, to think about what's going on inside the mind of someone who is struggling with a psychiatric illness, but also how that appears from the outside symptom-wise. Sort of to link the two, because I think something that can happen is we can just sort of disconnect the two and not think deeply. And there may be reasons we don't want to think deeply about the difficulties and the struggles of the people that we're seeing in front of us. And maybe the reason we don't want to think deeply about it is perhaps the other point of the paper, which is to do with mourning and loss and how mourning and loss pervades everything in life, but everything in psychiatry as well and everything in medicine. But I think we try very hard not to think about it because it's very painful. It's one of the most painful things in life is loss. And I think we try very hard not to think about it, but that's a loss for ourselves and it's a huge loss for our patients and our work with our patients. So in a nutshell, that was the aim of trying to bring something in a very sort of simple way to try and deepen the thinking around our patients' suffering.
So I think most people who are listening to this podcast will have a pretty clear idea of what they view as the psychiatric model of mental illness. They probably will also have a view as to what they think the psychoanalytic model of mental illness or the psychoanalytic view of mental illness is. But maybe you could just give a sort of a brief primer on what you mean when you say the psychoanalytic view of mental illness.
You see, I'm not sure. I think people tend to sit in one camp or the other and not think necessarily that much about the other side. But for me, it's like seeing with two eyes in the same head. It's very difficult. It's interesting, the lack of curiosity that can be in one camp or another. What I mean is I think psychiatrists contain, they have a very, very important containing role, and diagnosis and symptoms are very important as a containing function to help guide us in treatment and understanding where we're going with our patients and what might help them in a psychiatric way, whereas the psychoanalytic way of thinking is trying to understand the internal psychodynamics and what unites us all as human beings. And I think psychoanalysts, I mean, the nature of psychoanalysis is about loss and thinking about loss and mourning and how important that is in life. And maybe a part of psychiatric practice, because we're dealing with such intense and painful experiences, is trying not to think about mourning and loss.
And let me pick up on something you said just now, that everything is about loss and that loss is sort of everywhere. So just tell me a bit more what you mean by this. So if I was to see a patient later today or tomorrow, how would I sort of start to examine loss and what it means to them? Maybe we should actually go back even one step more and just define a little bit what you mean by loss or how we can think about this as a concept.
Okay, so it's a very helpful question. Actually, I think we all have a version of the world from when we're born all the way through our life. We have a picture of what the world is and it gets adapted with reality. We come up against reality and we have to adapt our picture of the world, our fantasies about what we're going to do with our lives, the relationships we're going to have, what we're going to achieve. We all have wonderful fantasies that we can be anything when we're a child. We can do anything. And as we get older, some of these options and opportunities drop away, sometimes because we're actually not good enough to be a very famous singer or a musician, or we might, for our own difficulties, not be able to do something, or we might meet resistance in the external world or the reality reality sort of hits us. So our whole life, we're having to face the adjustment of what we fantasize we might be. In when we're a baby, we fantasize we're the center of the universe. By the time we're not ever going to die, by the time we get to the end of life, we know we're not the center of the universe and we are going to die. And everybody around us has also died. There's a huge adjustment in perspective throughout life. And that, so life is one long loss event. If you think about the move from being a child to being a grandfather or grandmother and how much loss you have to really go through in a very clear and open way, with the loss of an awful lot of your friends and family, loss of your parents.
So I suppose it's loss in this sort of very concrete sense in which maybe we usually speak about it, which could be, you know, the death of a loved one or of someone significant in your life. But it's also loss in a way probably a lot of psychiatrists are not currently thinking about it, which is the loss of opportunity or the loss of hope or future or, you know, whatever other concept it is.
Well, if you think about it, you know, think about it from two different perspectives, being a doctor. Training to be a doctor is a huge loss event. You gain a lot, but also you have to face realities of life that you might otherwise not have known. You have to face illness and death a lot. You know, when you're quite young during your training, it's a huge challenge. And when you come to medical school, you've often been top of your class, you've been very bright, and you suffer a significant narcissistic loss when you come up against everybody else who's really bright, who's been the top of their class, and you're no longer. You're no longer that. You can't identify yourself with that. So there's this sort of sense of losses that are going on all the time. I mean, if I think about my training as a doctor, it was a really traumatic loss experience, actually. A lot of most days, you know. So, you know, you can feel very insignificant as a medical student. And abandoned, isolated. I think Adam Kay wrote wonderfully about this in his book about training in medicine.
Absolutely. And, you know, also a loss of many other things that you could have been doing with that those precious years of your 20s.
Yeah. And the reality that you're going to fail. And I think doctors, when I used to teach medical students, would come back to the same. When I was actually working through this paper and the ideas behind this paper, I'd talk to them about mourning and loss and the mourning process. And I would say, what's the biggest loss event you can imagine? And almost without fail, it was really striking. I was really surprised by it. It wasn't the same if I wasn't talking to medical students or doctors. The biggest loss event that they said time after time after time was failure. And I'd say, well, what do you mean? What do you even mean? And it was sort of incoherent, really, quite what failure meant. But failure was the biggest loss event that could be thought about. And the reality is you have to fail in medicine. You fail in medicine. You're up against your failures all the time. And as a group, I'm not sure we're that good at facing that.
I want to move on from what loss is, and clearly, you know, this is a complex thing to define, but I think most people can probably take a lot away from that discussion there about what we should be thinking about, into the next thing that you discuss in the paper, which is mourning, and then how mourning can be a model maybe by which we can understand psychiatric illnesses. So
I was going to come back just one step, because you said about meeting a patient and how meeting a patient. And I was thinking, well, for a patient to even see a doctor is a loss event. You have to face your own vulnerability, your own mortality to even go and see a doctor. So the way any patient behaves in the interaction with a doctor or a psychiatrist is going to be impacted by their response to this loss event.
Yes.
So then if we think a little bit about what happens when you suffer a loss event, you have a period of mourning. And if you can think about it most clearly, I think, with the loss of a loved one, I think that's where people can think most clearly about loss and mourning. But there's a period of grieving, of feeling different emotions in response to this loss. And psychoanalysts have talked about this in a lot of detail. They're saying, look, this is the work of life. Grieving, grief and mourning is the work of life. Now, it's incredibly painful. This work. It's hard work. Mourning is really hard work. It's very painful, and it goes on for a long time, and it takes an awful lot of energy. But if you do it, if you do lean into it, if you lean into this experience, that actually you grow as a person as a result of it. If it's successful, and I think they'll tend to talk about success in mourning, that actually once you've been through the mourning process, something that happens is instead of missing the person in the outside world who's gone, they become installed in your mind and they're always there for you. And people often talk about this. If you talk to people who've mourned significantly, they will talk about, well, no, my mother's always with me in my mind. She's always there to help and support me. So that if you have successful mourning, you install in your mind models or these versions of what you've lost, and you become stronger and more resilient as a result. So that's in a way, in a nutshell, what a lot of psychoanalytic writing and thinking is about, is saying this. This is what Freud talked about a lot.
Mm. So come on now to talk a little bit about the stages of grief. And I think most people are probably familiar with the stages of grief, but without wishing to go ahead with a slight spoiler, the latter part of your paper, you sort of put forward the idea that people may or may not be familiar with. This is not something that I'd consciously thought about before, that you can actually model different mental illnesses as being over or under uses of the different stages of grief that probably everyone listening is familiar with.
So a lot of clinicians and psychoanalysts, so clinicians such as Kubler-Ross, I mean, Kubler-Ross was an extremely important figure in mourning and loss. And she was a clinician who was involved in palliative care and worked with people who were dying. And she observed different stages of grief in people who were dying. But many clinicians and psychoanalysts have thought about this and broadly dividing the stages of mourning into initial denial, which is you have a loss event and you say, right, no, that hasn't happened. I'm fine. Nothing's happened. You get on with life as though something hasn't, you haven't just been hit with something. And we all might know that a bit. I remember it with the Twin Towers. When the Twin Towers happened, I remember watching it on the television and then just going off to a family therapy session as though it wasn't happening, as though something was not happening. And then the next stage, you see, denial is mediated by psychotic defenses. That's like something isn't happening. It's sort of denial. I'm going to get on with something. Then you move into, and that's a sort of way of coping, managing this shock. So you manage it in this sort of way with your defenses. Then when you're a bit further down the line and you can process it a bit more symbolically, you start using different defenses, but then you're still denying the loss and you go into a period of anger, guilt, blame, and even murderousness. And I think we can see this, I think, going on in Gaza at the moment, that there's a very profound loss event and the response to it is a war. So many of the powerfully destructive things that happen in life are a response to loss and mourning. And an acting out, if you like, in that stage of grief to do with anger and blame. So then you go into a stage of anger and blame, but still at that point, you're sort of denying the loss. You're not really taking it in. Then you go to a stage of bargaining, which is that you sort of know it's happened, but you think if you just do something, if I just pray to you, God, if I just pray that the cancer will get better, if I just eat really well, the cancer will go away. If I just do this. So it's a bit of magical thinking that actually you can reverse it, but you're sort of getting to the point where you're starting to accept it. And then there's the point of sort of swallowing the loss that you do accept it, that someone's gone, something's happened. There's no getting away from it. There's no going back on it. Because up until that point, and we see it a lot in mental health services, you know, this idea that we can, it's someone's fault, someone's to blame. And that's a way of trying not to take in that something has happened. So you swallow the loss, you take it in, you can't deny it anymore. You have to face it. And then there is the period of true grief. And that's what Freud talks about, is a period of the work of mourning, where someone retreats. There's a lot of rumination and memories. People might look at photos of the past or memories of the person that they've lost. They might, where previously they've not cleaned out their clothes or the cupboards, they might do that and spend time weeping or engaging with the memories. And that's a very, very painful process. But then there's a gradual emergence into a period of something called acceptance, and then the move to recovery. People talk about a sort of period that it takes about a year to do the first good work of mourning, and then it's sort of yearly cycles after that. But if you do it gradually, you gain in resilience, you start to be able to sort of develop.
Do you mean a year for each of the five stages, or a year?
No, a year for the cycle of it. So people talk about that to do with anniversaries, don't they? That
Yes.
mourning and grief comes up again in anniversaries. And people talk, oh, it's been 5 years now, it's been 6 years that people are cycling and reworking. And each time the internal picture of what's lost is getting more solidly installed. So the harder people work at it, the more creative output there can be. And you can see this within the suicide prevention movement. A lot of the very positive, I work a lot on suicide and suicide prevention, a lot of the very positive movements forwards have been driven by bereaved relatives of people that have died, so that actually grief can be a very powerfully creative force.
Mm. And maybe if this isn't jumping ahead too much, you could talk us through one of these case vignettes to try and help people listening understand how we can conceptualize people going through this grief cycle and maybe going through it, I don't know what the right word is, unsuccessfully or suboptimally. How we can sort of think about that as a model to understand things that otherwise you know, common diagnoses, so to speak.
So the whole underpinning of the paper is that all mental illness, which doesn't mean neurodiversity, this is mental illness, people who have developed mental illnesses, is a result of an arrest in the mourning process. And the different illnesses you get depend on where you have arrested in this process. And the arrests occur within the first two stages, in denial or in anger, blame, guilt. So there's different places the arrests occur. So, for example, and there are different reasons you get arrests in mourning. So if I could imagine it from my perspective, I can imagine there are losses that I could have, for example, the loss of my children, where I might, well, the loss is too great and I'm not going to want to mourn that. And you'll see it. And I saw it when I worked in a prison situation. If someone who'd had no mental illness whatsoever before murdered his partner and actually came in a psychotic state and actually remained in a psychotic state of mind because they couldn't come to terms with what they had done. This loss was too great for them to come to terms with. And so they retreated into a sort of psychotic, denied place and never emerged from it. Not as far as I know, did they ever really emerge for it and were never able to face what they'd done. And you see this in quite a few cases like that. So in that sort of situation, the loss is too great and there's a retreat into the state of arrest. You're not going to be able to mourn that. But where you see it very commonly and where I'd see it time and time again as a consultant psychiatrist, because I worked on an inpatient ward, I'd see it time and time again in an inpatient ward, would be a young person. I'm going to use an example of a young man who maybe had the hopes of his family and he'd achieved really well academically. He'd gone to university. And then at university, something happened and some breakdown happened. And he was admitted to the ward with a psychosis. I mean, in a way, you can't imagine a greater loss event for a family or for a young person to develop what would be diagnosed as schizophrenia and go on to become a chronic schizophrenic illness. It's such a profound loss, a loss of one's own future and capacities, but the loss of the family's hopes, the loss of the child that they thought they had. So it's a huge loss event, yet we don't really engage with that very much in psychiatry. And we sort of carry on as if that loss event isn't right in front of us. But if you think about some of the research on schizophrenia, which is that sometimes before people develop the positive symptoms of schizophrenia or the symptoms, there is actually some sort of cognitive impact. So that they lose, in some cases, the people who developed psychotic illnesses have lost the capacity for symbolic thinking. So they've lost some of their defenses. So they enter into this huge loss event, already disadvantaged with less of a capacity to process grief and loss because of less symbolic functioning. Then they're up against the biggest loss event, a huge loss event to mourn. And they haven't got the equipment with which to do it. They haven't got the symbolic equipment with which to do it. So a very common experience in ward rounds was talking to a young person, look, I think you've got this illness. No, I haven't. Absolutely haven't. I don't know what you're talking about. Every single person in the ward round might say, look, I think you do. No, I haven't. Absolutely haven't got it whatsoever. So this state of absolute denial that you get in psychotic illness is a result of a blockage in mourning. I cannot accept this. I can't process this. This has not happened. So that's a blockage at the early stage of mourning. And people with psychotic illnesses who remain in a psychotic with psychotic illness remain in this position of denial. So that's a sort of example of psychosis.
Maybe this is too complex a question to answer, but were I to see someone like that later today, you know, who's having a first episode of psychosis, and were I to try and apply the sort of loss or mourning model, should the clinician try and understand what was the index loss event? So if someone comes in and they say, you know, I'm psychotic, I'm having my first episode of psychosis, should I try and say, okay, you know, what's happened to you over the past few months? Is that the way to apply this practically?
Absolutely. It is to look for the loss event that underpins the diagnosis. Now, that doesn't mean ram it down your patient's face at all, but it means just try and help in understanding it. To try and understand it yourself helps you think about what might be helpful treatment-wise for somebody. I mean, you can certainly see it, for example, in families where their son or daughter has developed a psychotic illness that is likely to be diagnosed as schizophrenia, that the family can be in a state of denial. What we'd see, no, this isn't really what it is. This is because they've been smoking cannabis, or that this is because of something else. And the families might even not support them taking medication. And that would also be a way of understanding what the difficulty is there. So it helps in you thinking about the treatment pathway, not just for the person in front of you, but for the system around them as well. That was sort of psychosis and psychotic illness. But if we move on to a more, what would be considered neurotic illness like depression, it's easier to think about and to discuss, because I think the loss event is often clearer in depression. So the idea of depression is that someone isn't really sad. That's not what depression is. Someone is actually stuck and arrested in the anger part of the mourning process. And there's a defense mechanism called anger turned inwards, which is, you know, instead of being able to be angry with a person you're actually really angry with, you turn it on yourself. So depressed, when someone is in depression, they'll say, I just feel angry with myself. It's just me. I feel so guilty. I feel so angry with myself. So they've turned this inwards. And I think when someone is depressed, it's often much easier to see their loss event, and people will talk about it more. So I think in my paper, I use the example of a marital breakdown as the loss event. But then the depression, in a way, in the case example that I've used and I've seen so many times, actually holds the marriage together, because the partner is too fearful of leaving the husband because he's too depressed. So, you know, you get this collusion, if you like, around somebody, which maintains their illness and difficulty.
Yes. And once you do, if you do manage to identify the loss event, what is the next step to try and help someone through? I suppose the question is how explicit you would then be about the sort of formulation. Would you say to someone, listen, I think, you know, you've had this loss event, and I think you're a bit stuck in the sort of denial phase? Or how explicit would you be with trying to help someone through their problems?
I think it hugely depends on the situation and the relationship you're having with somebody. I think it should really inform your formulation. And then how you work with your own formulation depends very much on your situation and where you're working and how you're working with somebody and how well you know them. So, for example, if you're working psychotherapeutically with somebody, you might well be talking quite openly about these loss events. Whereas if you're meeting somebody in an emergency situation, you might not want to challenge someone immediately with some aspects of the formulation you have, but use it or what you think might be helpful for them. So if you see someone in an emergency situation like this, you might think, well, actually, some sort of psychotherapeutic input might be helpful, where some of this can be looked at or worked through, or some couples therapy, for example, or medication. So it would help. It depends on where you are and how you want to utilize, how you think in your patient's best interests you want to use your formulation. But it should definitely be a very important part of your formulation. And sometimes you can see very profoundly positive responses that actually you really can, if you're in a relationship with your patient where you can talk about it, there can be extremely helpful moves forward as a result of talking about it.
This has been a really interesting and thought-provoking discussion, and I think is a view of mental illness that lots of clinicians, myself included, have probably never thought explicitly about, but, you know, makes a great deal of sense when you read through the paper and from discussing with you now. There's some great takeaways in the paper. Is there any closing comment you would give to anyone, or any recommendation beyond reading and absorbing the paper that you think would help an average psychiatrist's practice?
I was just thinking about the Nick Cave quote, which I just think is marvelous. I think it's so helpful about it. And Nick Cave himself has suffered really tremendous losses. What it is to be human, it seems to me that the common agent that binds us all together is loss. And so the point of life must be measured in relationship to that loss. Our individual losses can be small or large. They can be accumulations of losses barely registered on a singular level, or force scales cataclysms. Loss is absorbed into our bodies from the moment we are cast from the womb until the end of our days, subsumed by it to become the essence of loss itself.
Fantastic quote to finish on. Rachel, thank you so, so much for joining us. That was Dr. Rachel Gibbons. We were discussing her new paper in BJ Psych Advances, The Mourning Process and Its Importance in Mental Illness, a psychoanalytic understanding of psychiatric diagnosis and classification. Thanks very much, Rachel.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this BJ Psych Advances podcast. For the latest updates, follow us on Twitter at the BJ Psych. To listen to more podcasts from the BJ Psych Journal portfolio, visit us on SoundCloud or search for us online.